Abraham Lincoln, Chapter 14, Last Days of a Great Life. The second inauguration of Lincoln took place without unusual incident on March 4, 1865. The event is marked especially by the beauty of his inaugural address, which is known as the Second Inaugural. This was one of the noblest state papers ever written, and in its tenderness, almost prophetic. Passing lightly over the matter of his policies, which, he said, were too well known to be discussed, he closed with a passage that has come to be regarded as a classic of our language. The words fell like a benediction upon those who heard them. They were like the parting counsel of a father spoken to those he loves, and proved to be in reality a farewell to the American people. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. The message reveals clearly the depth and strength of Lincoln's religious nature, which is traceable in all the crises of his life. It harks back to the early days when his soul was attuned to nature and God in the vast solitudes of the wilderness. There we can see him as a little boy kneeling with his mother and sister at a small grave in the Kentucky woodland. Again, in the Indian's clearing, we see him at the bedside of that dying Christian mother, and feel that his spirit is answering back to hers as the door opens for her on the eternal mysteries, and she bids her son goodbye. Along through the years of his early manhood, in all his relations of life, private and public, there is evident a deep and constant sense of duty and of trust in a higher power. This abiding faith is most clearly manifested in the stormy, tempestuous years of his life in the White House. When he entered upon his duties as president, it seemed to the world that our nation was entrusting her destiny to an uncertain pilot in a frail bark. Even his friends were fearful. But in Lincoln's soul, there was no doubt. His farewell words to his friends and neighbors on that chilly February morning in 1861, "Without the assistance of that divine being, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail," show the source of the strength and calmness which never forsook him. As defeat followed defeat, and one disaster crowded upon another in the early days of the war, his faith and courage never wavered. In one of the darkest hours, when the Merrimack threatened to destroy the Union fleet and the country was in panic, we hear the clear, calm voice of Lincoln declaring, "I have not the slightest fear of any result which shall fatally impair our military and naval strength. This is God's fight, and he will win in his own good time. He will take care our enemies do not press us too far." At another time he said, "I have been driven to my knees many times by the overwhelming conviction that I have nowhere else to go." The week after the Battle of Gettysburg, General Sickles, who had been in the battle, asked Mr. Lincoln if he had not been anxious during the Gettysburg campaign. Mr. Lincoln replied, "I had no fear." "How could that be?" asked the general. "In the pinch of your campaign up there," replied Lincoln, "when everybody seemed panic-stricken and nobody could tell what was going to happen, I went into my room one day and locked the door, and got down on my knees before Almighty God and prayed to him mightily for a victory at Gettysburg. I told God that if we were to win the battle, he must do it, for I had done all I could. I told him this was his war and our cause was his cause, but that we couldn't stand another Fredericksburg or Chancellorsville. And then and there, I made a solemn vow to Almighty God that if he would stand by our boys at Gettysburg, I would stand by him. And he did, and I will. And after that, I don't know how it was, and I can't explain it, But soon a sweet comfort crept into my soul that things would go all right at Gettysburg, and that is why I had no fears about you. It has been well said that Lincoln lived in the spirit. Of creeds and dogmas he was no lover. He said, "Whenever any church will inscribe over its altar as a qualification of membership the Savior's statement of the substance of the long gospel, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and thy neighbor as thyself, that church will I join with all my heart and soul." Holding firmly to the belief that if we do right, God will be with us, and if God is with us, we cannot fail, it was a sore trial and perplexity to him that the Union cause was so slow in winning. He believed it was a righteous cause, and yet God did not bring victory to the Union armies. After pondering long, he reached the conclusion that the Civil War was a punishment to the American people, both North and South, for the crime of enslaving the Negroes. This belief is clearly set forth in the second inaugural, in which he says, "The Almighty has his own purposes. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from these divine attributes which the believers in a living God ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another's drawn with the sword, as said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." In less than a month after Lincoln's second inauguration, Grant had succeeded in forcing Lee out of Richmond, April 2nd. Lee then retreated westward with the purpose of joining General Johnston, who was moving toward him from the south. But Grant followed closely to catch up with Lee before the two armies could unite, and it seemed inevitable that Lee's surrender must come soon. In anticipation of this important event, concerning which it seemed desirable that he should have personal conferences with the commanding general, late in March, Lincoln visited Grant's headquarters at City Point on the James River. Soon after his arrival, Mrs. Lincoln and Tad joined him, and his son Robert came from Harvard to experience something of the soldier's life as a member of Grant's staff. During his stay, Lincoln often rode with Grant miles and miles over the corduroy roads of the swamps, while at night he sat by the campfires and exchanged stories with the officers. Believing that the long period of fighting was near its close, he seemed to enjoy a sense of freedom from the nerve-wearing anxiety of the White House. On hearing of Lee's retreat, he said, "I must see Richmond." When he reached the city, he found disorder, confusion, and chaos everywhere. Although he knew that his life was in danger in the Confederate capital, he walked for a mile and a half through the streets, leading Tad by the hand, with no guard except 10 Marines. As he passed along, the Negroes crowded about him in their eagerness to touch his garments. Some, with tears of gratitude, fell upon their knees at his feet, as in worship. But he said, "Do not kneel to me, that is not right." And then, gently, "God bless you, and let me pass on." When the party entered the building, which was used as Union headquarters, and which had also been the official residence of the Confederate president, someone remarked to Lincoln, "Jefferson Davis ought to be hanged." The forbearing president promptly responded, "Judge not, that ye be not judged." When, a few days later, Mrs. Lincoln remarked to a friend that the national capital was filled with our enemies, the president, hearing her words, raised his arm and, with a lack of his usual gentleness and patience, retorted, "Enemies, we must never speak of that." Even in the hour of victory, he harbored no bitterness against any human being, and was strongly opposed to harsh measures against the Confederate leaders. This is plainly indicated in his plan to restore peaceful relations between the warring sections of the Union with as little friction as possible. In his plan of Reconstruction, which he had been for many months forecasting, he displayed not only freedom from malice toward the Confederate States, but also his exceptional and marked practical common sense. "We all agree," he declared, "that the seceded states, so-called, are out of their proper practical relation with the Union, and that the sole object of the government, civil and military, in regard to these states, is to again get them into the proper practical relation. I believe that it is not only possible, but in fact easier to do this without deciding or even considering whether these states have ever been out of the Union than with it. Finding themselves safely at home, it would be utterly immaterial whether they have ever been abroad." But Lincoln could not wait at City Point for the final act in the Great Campaign, being called back to Washington by an accident to Secretary Seward. By the time he reached Washington, however, Lee had surrendered, April 9th, and the Capitol was already rejoicing. Everywhere in the North there was unbounded enthusiasm, for Lee's surrender meant that the war was practically at an end. But to no one could it mean so much as to the worn and harassed president. The strain of the load he had carried during the terrible years of the war was written in the unspeakable sadness of his countenance. On one occasion he said, in weariness of spirit, "I feel as though I shall never be glad any more." On another he remarked, with his whimsical smile, "I wish George Washington or some other old patriot were here to take my place for a while so that I could have a little rest." But after it became certain that the war would end in favor of the Union, there came a marked change in his looks and ways. His face brightened, and he began to appear more like the light-hearted Lincoln of former days. Again, also, he took a special interest in all that suggested peace and repose. He enjoyed reading over and over poems that spoke of things serene and peaceful. He liked to linger in quiet spots. Many years later, Mrs. Lincoln told the following incident, which took place while they were still at Grant's headquarters in Virginia. They were driving one day along the James River and came to a country cemetery. It was a quiet, shaded spot. They got out of their carriage and walked among the graves, Mr. Lincoln looking serious and thoughtful. In a few moments he said to his wife, "Mary, you are younger than I. You will survive me. When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet spot like this." Again in Washington, the president at once set in motion the formal business of closing the war. His first measure was an order suspending the draft, and this was published in the newspapers of Friday morning, April 14th. Great joy spread like a tidal wave over the country. The cry, "Lee has surrendered! The war is over!" was repeated again and again. It broke on every town, village, and wayside settlement, until it seemed as if the winds of heaven had taken it up and tossed it back and forth. Perils and hardships and all the black evil of war were for the time forgotten. In countless homes, mothers wept and laughed in turn as they thought of the homecoming of their boys. Even those who had lost their dear ones were glad that the turmoil would soon end and that they had not sacrificed their treasure in vain. Bells were rung, flags were unfurled, and the national colors, decorating buildings and waving from flagstaffs on every side, never appeared more beautiful. It was a happy people that gave welcome to this Good Friday of April 14th, 1865. The day, usually observed by many with fasting and prayer, was on this occasion filled with a spirit of profound thanksgiving. Spring and hope were in the warm sunshine and balmy air, while budding trees and blooming flowers symbolized the joy that was blossoming again in human hearts. Nothing gave hint of the awful tragedy that was so soon to bring gloom to the country. Grant had arrived in Washington that morning to be present at the cabinet meeting held as usual on Friday. Many questions were asked regarding the safety of General Sherman, for it was thought that he was on the point of meeting in battle with General Johnston somewhere in the Carolinas. Several of the cabinet were anxious about the situation, but Lincoln was not. He said he was sure that good news would come from that quarter, because he had dreamed the night before the same dream that had come to him several times on the eve of great battles. It had preceded the battles of Murfreesboro, Antietam, Gettysburg, and Vicksburg. He had no doubt that a battle had taken place, or soon would take place, and he went on, "Johnston will be beaten, for I had this strange dream again last night. It must relate to Sherman. My thoughts are in that direction, and I know of no other very important event which is likely just now to occur." Fateful dream! It was the forerunner of a catastrophe greater than any battle of the war. The day was a happy one for Mr. Lincoln. Captain Robert Lincoln was home from service under General Grant, and father and son had an hour's talk over the campaign. That afternoon the president and his wife took a long drive. His mood was very cheerful and tender. While they were out together, he said, "Mary, we have had a hard time of it since we came to Washington, but the war is over, and with God's blessing, we may hope for 4 years of peace and happiness, and then we will go back to Illinois and pass the rest of our lives in quiet. I will open a law office at Springfield or Chicago and practice law, and at least do enough to help give us a livelihood." Never had Lincoln seemed in happier spirit than on this day of great triumph. His heart was filled with gratitude to God and overflowed in love and kindness to his fellow men. We like to dwell on this brief period of his life, when the heavy burdens of the war lifted and the joy of achieved purpose reflected itself in his lightened countenance and cheerful bearing. Stanton said of him, "I never saw him so happy." But his wife, more apprehensive, said, "I never saw you like this except before our dear Willie died." Mrs. Lincoln's elusive foreboding soon gave place to shocking reality. She had arranged a theater party for that evening at Ford's Theater in honor of General and Mrs. Grant, who were guests at the White House. The papers had announced that they were to occupy a box. But as General and Mrs. Grant decided to go north, Miss Harris and Major Rathbun, daughter and stepson of Senator Ira Harris, were invited to take their places. When evening came, Lincoln seemed loath to go, but he said, "The people will be disappointed," and so the plan was carried out. The president's party did not reach the theater until after the play, The American Cousin, had begun. When they entered, the band struck up "Hail to the Chief." There was great enthusiasm. The audience cheered, the men waved their hats, and the women their handkerchiefs, the action of the play being suspended meanwhile. The party in the box laid aside their wraps and turned, smiling and bowing, as they took their seats. During the play, Mr. Lincoln, who occupied an armchair near the railing in plain sight of the audience, chatted in a genial way with the members of his party and laughed with the audience at the flashes of humor in the dialogue. During the third act, had the audience been watching, they might have observed a dark, handsome young man going along the corridor and entering the passage which led to the president's box. It was the actor, John Wilkes Booth, an extreme secessionist, excited by hate at the downfall of his cause. Having entered, he closed the door and fastened it so that it could not be opened from the outside. Then, stealthily entering the box, he took deliberate aim and shot the president in the back of the head. Major Rathbun at once grappled with the assassin and received a deep and wide wound in his arm from the knife Booth carried in his left hand. The murderer, tearing himself away, leaped from the box to the stage. In so doing, he caught the spur of his left foot in the silken flag draping the box and fell so heavily that he broke his leg. But he was able to get to his feet, and limping across the stage, he faced the audience and shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis! Thus be it always to tyrants!" Then, before anyone could reach him, he rushed through a familiar exit to the street, where a horse awaited him. The audience was at first startled, then stunned, as it realized what had happened. The shot, a woman's cry, a cloud of smoke, all had taken place in a moment of time. Major Rathbun's shout, "Stop him! He has shot the president!" roused them to the horror of the situation. Then, in helpless rage and grief, some rushed, shouting to the stage in pursuit of the murderer. Others ran to the box. Surgeons came, and the silent figure of the president was borne from the theater to the street and across the way to the nearest house. There, in a small room, he was laid unconscious upon the bed. He lingered throughout the night, tenderly watched by those about him, his family, members of the cabinet, and other friends. A little after 7 the next morning, he died. As he breathed his last, Secretary Stanton, who had become Lincoln's devoted friend, said, "Now he belongs to the ages." All night, while the spirit of the president was passing into the unseen, Washington had been in a ferment of confusion and horror. Messengers had been hurrying hither and yon, spreading the news and bearing orders from the Secretary of War, who at once put the city under military control. Next morning, all the papers gave news of the tragedy. The shock and horror of it spread everywhere. A pall of silence fell over the people, and they walked with bowed heads and whitened faces. In New York, shops were closed. All business was suspended. The joy of yesterday was forgotten in the universal sorrow. Flags and bunting gave place to emblems of grief and mourning. From the Battery to the Park, public buildings and private dwellings were draped in black. Even the meanest hovel in the poorest quarter displayed some token, however simple, of sorrow for the death of the president. Similar signs of mourning were visible in all the great cities of the North and in all the towns and villages. The general grief spread even to the remote farms. All classes, especially the plain people, felt that they had lost a friend. On the following Wednesday, while funeral services were being held at 12 o'clock in the White House, business was suspended, and similar services were conducted in churches throughout the North. Thus, in unison, did the people of the nation pay their last formal tribute of devotion to the martyred president. The next morning, the funeral train bearing the body of Abraham Lincoln to its last resting place near Springfield, Illinois, started on its sad journey of nearly 2,000 miles. The route was almost the same as that by which, as president-elect, he had come to Washington a little more than 4 years before. As the funeral cortege passed on its way, there were almost continuous demonstrations of sorrow. In the large centers the funeral train rested, the casket was borne through the streets, and the body of the president lay in state, while an innumerable throng gazed upon the face of their dead hero. Even at the smallest country stations, the people, in reverent silence, stood with bared heads and tear-filled eyes as the funeral train moved by. The silent dead passed between continuous walls of living people. Day or night, rain or shine, there was the same constant attendance, and the somber emblems of mourning along the route were only less impressive than the crowds of grief-stricken people. But the most tender of all the expressions of love and sorrow came from those who had been his friends and neighbors before he was called to the White House. As they looked upon his familiar face for the last time, they thought of him not as the emancipator of the slaves, nor as President of the United States, but as one who, in earlier years, had been kind and helpful in 1,000 ways. Even though Lincoln has taken his place among the immortals, his memory still lives, and his influence pervades the life of the nation whose leader he was. What it was in his great soul that enabled him, untutored and untrained in conventional ways, to control for 4 years the destiny of a great people, we may not understand. But we may recognize in his righteous purpose, his clear understanding, his wise judgment, his earnest efforts to do what was right, the means by which he reached his goal. With unflinching devotion, he pushed resolutely forward, never changing, never swerving. When he believed he was in the right, no matter what ridicule or abuse was heaped upon his head. Many times he was cut to the quick by an ungrateful nation or an unworthy follower. But to know his duty and to do it were his sole concern. Although inflexible in the path of duty, he never failed in his gentle forgiveness of those who wronged him and in his sympathetic care of those who sought his help. He was a father to the soldiers, a friend to the widowed and the orphaned, and he yearned to enfold the nation in his protecting care. He was so simple and modest in manner that those with whom he walked did not realize his greatness. But when death suddenly removed him, the world, by a quick instinct, recognized him as one of the greatest of men. It beheld a conqueror who had led the nation through many perils, achieving his purpose and accomplishing his task. With malice toward none, with charity for all, he had saved the Union and had freed the slaves.